Good morning, and welcome to our MPI webinar, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA at 2. My name is Michael Fix, and I'm the president of the Migration Policy Institute, and what I want to do here for a couple of minutes is just provide a little information on the logistics of this webinar and some background on MPI's new report on DACA. The new report is actually the latest in a series of MPI, National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy reports on DACA, and it, as well as the slides and audio of this webinar, and I must add, as well as a very zippy new data tool that maps the DACA population by state and eventually by county, are available on our website at www.migrationpolicy.org. And if you have any technical problems accessing this webinar, please contact us by email at events@migrationpolicy.org or call us at 202-266-1929. We'll have a question and answer period at the end of this panel, so if you want to ask a question to us, make a comment. You can, if you want to ask the panel a question or make a comment, what you can do is use the chat function throughout the webinar, but be aware that the chat function will be visible to other participants. Or you can send us an email at events@migrationpolicy.org with your questions. Now to our presenters of the day. The presenters include myself, and in addition, two of the report's distinguished authors, Jana Batalova, a demographer and senior policy analyst here at MPI, and Sarah Hooker, a policy analyst and education specialist here at the Institute. And our final speaker will be Margie McHugh, the director of our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. Say a word about the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. Margie and I co-founded it in 2007. It has and continues to focus on a range of integration issues, mostly in the U.S., but increasingly in Europe. So among the issues we address include children and youth and immigrant families, education from early childhood to post-secondary, adult basic education and workforce development, the governance of integration policy at state and national levels, where we have an abiding interest, we should confess, in the creation of a national office on immigrant integration policy. And the center is administered and in many quarters is known for its E Pluribus Unum prizes that has awarded substantial grants and recognition to exemplary immigrant integration programs. Now let me turn to the report. In the report, what's distinguished about this report is that we not only examine the youth population who had applied initially, and in this case for renewals from DACA, but also, if you will, the pool of eligibles who could potentially apply. And we did this by using innovative demographic techniques initially developed at the Population Center at Penn State University and by Jim Bachmeyer at Temple University, who is also a report co-author. Jana Batalova will discuss this methodology in a bit greater, but I promise you not too much greater detail later in the call. So as a bit of a primer, what did DACA do? Well, in a word, it provided relief from deportation and extended work authorization to unauthorized youth who'd entered the U.S. before they were 16, had been in the U.S. since June 2007, had a high school degree, or importantly are or have been enrolled in a GED or an education and training program leading to post-secondary education. It seems to us that the program is notable in part because it's temporary, provides administrative, not legislative, relief. It can and it has been renewed for 2 years. And like the now almost 10-year-old DREAM Act, DACA links legal status to educational attainment, creating both new incentives to learn, but also potential barriers to legal status. That said, we would point out that DACA sets a lower education bar, a high school degree, than the often proposed but not yet enacted DREAM Act that in essence requires 2 years of college. Now, the importance of DACA, we think, bears mentioning. First, there is, of course, the importance to the DACA recipients themselves, to whom it provides an opportunity to integrate at a critical stage in the life cycle. They can get a driver's license, pay for school, in some cases get in-state tuition, work legally, and the like. You could also argue that DACA demonstrated to some skeptics that a large-scale legalization program was, however challenging, institutionally workable within the Department of Homeland Security. And its success, I think, owed in part to the transparent rules published in a timely manner and close coordination with some community-based organizations. And then finally, DACA is important because it remains the principal opportunity to obtain legal status in the absence of legislative immigration reform. So with that, let me turn the program over to Jana.
Thank you, Michael, and good morning, everyone. In this report, we update our last year's analysis of the potential universe of youth eligible for DACA using more recent data as well as an innovative and improved methodology to estimate legal status of respondents in population surveys. Without going into wonky methodological details, just let me tell you a few words about the methodology. We draw on two data sources. One is the most recent DACA application data from the USCIS, and two, a unique data set based on the most recent American Community Survey for 2012, with immigration status assigned based on responses to another Census Bureau's national survey, the 2008 Survey of Income and Participation and Program Participation. And the basic innovation here is to link the SIP, which asked directly questions about legal status, to the large-scale American Community Survey that provides the statistical heft needed to make estimates at the national, state, and county levels. Our methodology allows us to present a highly detailed portrait of a population that has traditionally remained in the shadows. Being a good data detective, I should also mention a few data limitations. The available data do not allow us to measure criminal history and continuous U.S. presence. Because we are unable to model these factors, we may potentially overestimate the size of the eligible population. On the other hand, we may underestimate the eligible population because we do not model enrollment in qualifying adult education programs, also due to lack of data. And since the most recently available Census Bureau data are from 2012, a significant number of youth reached the age of 15 and thus have aged into program eligibility by 2014. While we account for these possible transitions in and out of eligibility to some degree, due to data limitations, we cannot do it for the entire analysis. In the report and in this presentation, we carefully spell out which groups we are describing and which time periods we refer to. Now back to our most interesting and in some cases surprising factors. With the age and human capital requirements that Michael mentioned earlier in mind, we estimated that the overall universe of potentially eligible individuals for DACA at the program's launch in 2012 was 2.1 million. Within this potentially eligible universe, there were three subgroups. Number one, immediately eligible youth. About 58% or more than 1.2 million of potentially eligible youth met DACA's age and education criteria at program's launch. The second group consists of the 426 youth who did not meet education requirements at program's launch. This group may become eligible if they enroll in an education, literacy, or career training program. And some of these youth might have enrolled in such programs since 2012. The last group consists of 473,000 children under the age 15 who were too young to apply for the program in 2012, but would become eligible once they reach age 15 if they stay in school. Given the age distribution of this population, the number of children aging into eligibility we estimate will range from annually from 80 to 90,000 people between 2013 and 2016, and then decline dramatically after that. Now that we got some sense of who and how many might be eligible for DACA program, let's take a look at the most recent application data from USCIS. The statistics covered on this slide refer to the period between August 15, 2012 and July 20th of 2014. As you can see, USCIS accepted for processing more than 680,000 DACA initial applications. About 86% or 587,000 were approved, and just under 4% were denied, with the remainder awaiting a decision. We also have information on renewals. Between June 5th and July 20th of 2014, USCIS has accepted nearly 25,000 renewal applications. We find that this statistic impressive, given that in the first 3 months of DACA in 2012, there were 53,000 approved applications, which means that nearly half of those who were approved had already applied for renewal by July 20th. Now, let's look at the application rates for initial applications. Using our estimate of 1.2 million immediately eligible youth at the program's launch in 2012, and assuming that only this group was able to apply, we calculate that 55% nationwide have applied. If we consider the entire potentially eligible population, that includes both immediately eligible and those eligible but for education, our estimate of application rate is lower, about 41% of the 1.7 million who were eligible. Similar to our findings last year, we find that application rates vary significantly by state. These data are based on application data submitted between August 15th of 2012 and March 31st of 2014. When we look at the 15 states with the largest DACA populations, we find that immediately eligible youth were most likely to apply for the program if they resided in Arizona, Texas, Nevada and Colorado, and North Carolina. They were least likely to apply in Massachusetts, New Jersey, Virginia, Florida, and Maryland. Differences in state application rates in part reflect differences in population composition, language diversity, access to information, and state policies, and the climate of reception for immigrants. We also find significant differences in terms of national origin. Compared to their share among the total DACA eligible population, Latin American youth were more likely to apply, while Asian youth were less likely to do so. As this chart shows, more than 60% of immediately eligible youth from Honduras, Mexico, and Peru applied for DACA through March 31st. In contrast, less than 30% of immediately eligible Koreans, Filipinos, and Indians had applied to that date. Moreover, as in our last year report, Chinese youth are still absent among the top 20 origin groups among DACA applicants, even though China ranked ninth among the top 10 eligible to apply. So why do we observe high application rates for Latina youth and low for Asians? Evidence from the field suggests that greater awareness and continuous discussion in Hispanic media and community-based organizations about the legalization options for the entire unauthorized population and for the dream-like population plays a big role. Also, Asian youth are more likely to reside in states with friendlier immigration policies, and hence the need to apply for DACA protection is less urgent. New this year is our analysis of application rates by gender and age. These data are based on the period through September 2013. We find that women were more likely to apply than men, even though they made up a smaller share of the immediately eligible population. But in terms of the application rate, the pattern by gender is reverse. 51% of women applied versus only 43% of men. Why? Well, because young men are more likely to drop out of school. They may face difficulties meeting the education requirements under DACA. Additionally, men are far more likely than women to have criminal histories that would disqualify them from applying. We also find that younger DACA youth were more likely to apply than older ones. Comparing our estimates to the data on applications from USCIS report, we find that 53% of the immediately eligible youth in the 15 to 19 age group applied versus 33% of DACA eligible who were 25 and over. Youth aging 15 to 19 may experience fewer barriers to applying for DACA because they're more likely to be still in school and thus have fewer barriers to documenting their eligibility and length of residence in the United States. This group may also have greater exposure to counseling and information resources on DACA as they are preparing for post-secondary education and workforce transitions. I'm going to turn to my colleague Sarah, who will describe most interesting findings about immediately eligible for education, and future eligible groups. And she will also discuss the barriers and opportunities these three groups are likely to facing in applying and reapplying for DACA. Sarah?
Thanks, Jana. So moving beyond the application rates, I'm going to provide more details on our estimates of the population that could potentially benefit from DACA. This slide zeroes in on the population that was immediately eligible at DACA's launch, meaning that they were ages 15 to 30 and had at least a high school diploma or were enrolled in school. This year, our data allow us to take a closer look at their educational attainment and school enrollment, factors that, as we've already mentioned, are central tenets of DACA eligibility and are of great interest to policymakers and service providers. We find that of the immediately eligible group, just 8% already had at least a two-year college degree. As Michael mentioned, it's important to note that previous versions of the DREAM Act introduced in Congress have required a post-secondary degree or at least 2 years in a bachelor's degree program as conditions for permanent legal residence or a fast track to citizenship. This 8% clearly would meet that requirement were this legislation to pass. However, a full 20% of immediately eligible youth, about 247,000 individuals, had completed a high school diploma and were enrolled in college, though they had not yet completed a degree. This is a particularly important target group from the perspective of promoting college degree completion among the so-called dreamers. The red bar on this chart represents those who had completed high school but were not enrolled in college, 41%. And finally, approximately one-third were still enrolled in grades K through 12. When we compare the profiles of immediately eligible youth with those who were eligible except for the education requirements, those in the rightmost column of this chart, we find that they differ in profound ways with important implications for policy and service provision. First, some of those who did not appear to meet DACA's education requirements had very low levels of education. 38% had only completed eighth grade or less. That group was also more likely to have limited English proficiency at 69% versus 28% of the immediately eligible group. They have high rates of poverty across both groups, but particularly across the group that is eligible except for education. However, those who are eligible except for education are likely to be among the working poor. 72% are in the labor force. But their unauthorized status and low education levels likely mean that they are concentrated in low-wage, lower-skilled jobs. 62% are male versus 53% of immediately eligible youth. And finally, they are overwhelmingly from Mexico or Central America, 94% of those who are eligible except for education, versus 76% of immediately eligible youth. The third group of potentially eligible youth described in our brief and that Jana mentioned consists of the children who were under 15 at DACA's launch but met all of the other requirements and will likely become eligible in the future. As Jana mentioned, there were 473,000 of these children, about a quarter of whom were limited English proficient, but nearly three quarters of whom were fully bilingual, speaking English very well as speaking another language at home, which we consider to be an encouraging finding. On a less positive note, however, 81% are in families with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level, so high rates of economic disadvantage among this group. This population is aging into eligibility, provided that they stay in school, at a rate of 80 to 90,000 individuals per year. And as Jana mentioned, the last cohort will reach age 15 in 2022. This is because of DACA's current provisions that state that youth must have been in the United States since June 15, 2007, 5 years before DACA began. So they must have been at least 5 years old at DACA's launch. Finally, for the first time in this year's brief, we were able to examine the characteristics of youth potentially eligible for DACA in 25 states. We did this by using pooled data from 2008 to 2012. This five-year data set was necessary for us to have adequate sample sizes to examine detailed characteristics for each state. This slide gives a quick glimpse of some of the findings. First, we looked at population diversity. Mexico was the top country of origin in all but three of these states, Maryland, Virginia, and Massachusetts. And Massachusetts was especially interesting because Brazil is the top country of origin, indicating the importance of outreach and services in Portuguese, as well as other non-Spanish languages. We saw substantial variation in educational attainment and enrollment. For instance, we saw differences in the share of immediately eligible youth who were enrolled in college, ranging from a high of 27% in Massachusetts, Michigan, and Pennsylvania to 13% in Arizona. We also saw variations in the shares living in low-income families, with the highest rates in low-income families in several southern and western states. Meanwhile, we saw less poverty or lower rates of those in low-income families in several mid-Atlantic and East Coast states. These patterns tend to mirror overall state-by-state differences in income level, housing costs, and levels of educational attainment for the general population. And finally, we are excited to introduce a new feature on our website today. You can learn more about these state-level findings through this new data tool that is being released on our website. This picture gives you a glimpse of what it looks like. The online tool consists of two main features: a map where you can find the estimates of top-line numbers of potentially eligible DACA youth in 41 states that had adequate sample sizes. And we can see here an example of California and the top-line numbers of the population in California, and a more detailed profile of the characteristics, including education, poverty, and additional characteristics that I did not discuss, for 25 states, those that are in dark purple on this map. So we encourage you to check it out and hope this tool can be useful to you in your efforts to better understand the DACA population in your state. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Margie McHugh.
Thank you, Sarah, and thanks to all of you who have joined us this morning for this webinar. I'm just going to speak briefly about what we see as some of the top-line integration implications from the report and also from other work we're engaged in. NPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy has invested heavily in helping the public know more about the characteristics of the DACA population because the program has such significant implications from an integration policy and program perspective. Looking at the program through a very broad lens, it's targeted to young adults who are making the transition to adulthood, finishing their education, entering the workforce, establishing their own households, and in many cases, becoming parents. DACA removes some of the serious barriers that prevented unauthorized youth who entered the country as children from preparing for and transitioning to more successful adult lives. However, because such a large portion of potentially eligible DACA youth does not yet meet the education requirements of the program, it is clear that many hundreds of thousands of potential applicants would need more than just information and legal guidance or support in meeting the program's requirements. They also need to access education or training programs that would help them to meet the program's application requirements. As we at MPI think about those requirements, we focus on four key subpopulations. They are those who are under 18, over 18 with no high school diploma, over 18 with only a high school diploma, and those who are over 18 with some college. Only about 20% of potentially eligible DACA youth are under 18 or at a typical middle or high school age where they might be more easily reached through organized school systems and where they have a legal right to enroll in school and receive a free public education. As this table shows, however, the vast majority of potential DACA youth, 62%, are ages 20 to 32, where access to education and training opportunities are less formal or organized. They can often be expensive and/or in short supply, and where legal status restrictions may apply. Drawing on other studies our center has published and some of the data in this new report, I'll just briefly point to some of the challenges and opportunities facing DACA youth as they attempt to meet the program's education requirements. Given high dropout rates for many immigrant and Latino youth, a focus on quality instruction for current and former English language learners is needed in order to ensure that they're able to progress towards receiving a high school diploma, developing strong academic English language skills that will allow them to meet the new and tougher course content and graduation standards that most states have adopted. In order to help them do this, a range of dropout prevention programs, college counseling, and other academic supports may be needed. For those who are older without a high school diploma, we see both a great need for them to be able to access adult basic education. It's a very big concern that there are very limited seats in adult basic education and ESL programs. Current estimates are that the available program slots through the federally and state-funded system meet less than 5% of the need that's out there in the country, and there are even fewer effective models that would be able to progress DACA youth to the diplomas and the degrees that they're seeking. Looking to state and local policies, we see that a number of states actually have policies that prevent unauthorized youth from being eligible for adult basic education programs that they would presumably need to enroll in if they didn't have a high school diploma in order to qualify for DACA. And then there are also many barriers that present both a challenge and an opportunity to folks who care about the educational success of these youth that have to do with the time required to enroll in and advance in the programs that they might seek to be engaged with, transportation and childcare needs that are difficult to meet very often, and also computer access and literacy. So before closing and turning to your questions, I also wanted to highlight the importance of continued educational attainment for those who meet the education requirements for DACA but would not meet them should DREAM Act-like legislation eventually be enacted. Focusing on these individuals is important given the ramifications that their academic success has for their lifelong earnings and their socioeconomic status, the trajectory that they're on, and also because of the need for them to potentially take steps now to complete at least 2 years of college that would help them both in terms of their life prospects, but also provide an advantage in meeting potential DREAM Act or similar requirements that could be otherwise difficult for them to complete. In order to help these two populations do that, there's something called Bridge Programs, which we'd be happy to share more information about with many of you. They're very popular now in the adult education field, trying to provide a bridge to older students into post-secondary institutions. And there are many other affordability measures or other completion supports that we know a lot about in the fields of college access and completion, but which need scaling in order to be able to accommodate the needs of the large number of immigrant youth who might be seeking to take advantage of them. So because of the importance of these education success issues for immigrant youth and the overall success of immigration policy efforts like DACA and potential DREAM Act-like legislation, our center will publish several new reports this fall that provide a more detailed look at policies and programs that can support educational success of key DACA subpopulations. So with that, I'll turn it back to Michael as we begin to take some of your questions.
Well, I assume you're going to have a lot of questions about this presentation and about these very interesting data and about these very interesting policy suggestions and conclusions that we have been drawing. And now is the time to file your questions and your comments as well. I presume that we're going to get more than we can respond to within the scope of the next half hour, but we will speak quickly and do our best. So let me just start with two questions that we have already in the hopper. The first one is, when will the new data tool take counties into account, and when will the county data be available on the data tool? I think Jana want to take a shot at that.
Right. So right now we release the national and state level data, and we're currently working on developing similar estimates for the county at the county level, both the top line estimates as well as the more detailed profiles. And we'll be releasing the data in the coming weeks, perhaps in the end of August or early September.
Great. Thanks. And so now we have another question. Does the 20% who completed high school and enrolled in college but don't have a degree include only those who are currently enrolled, or also those who've been enrolled in college in the past but not currently?
So our estimates, population estimates, and both Sarah and I mentioned, they are as of DACA's launch, so as of 2012, because that's the only data set that we have, the American Community Survey. So we acknowledge that there might have been some transitions in and out of the programs, but due to data limitation, we cannot model them. So the population estimates that you see are as of 2012.
I have a question for Sarah, my own personal question for Sarah. Would you muse for just a minute or two about the implications of the high and low college going rate and across different states within the DACA population?
Sure. There definitely are various things that could have played a role in that. For instance, when we saw that some of the states that had higher levels of educational attainment were some of the states that overall have higher levels of educational attainment. Some of the variation reflects sort of overall population trends that are not necessarily specific to the immigrant population, the higher states being Massachusetts, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That said, there could be some factors related to policies that make it more difficult for unauthorized immigrant youth to enroll in college. For instance, Arizona, Georgia, having more restrictive policies with regard to in-state tuition, financial aid, and overall college access. So there definitely could be a mixture of trends just related to overall educational attainment levels of the population. Some barriers that are unique to unauthorized youth. Meanwhile, several of the states that had higher rates are also states that have at least in-state tuition available for unauthorized immigrants, and in some cases, state financial aid as well. And finally, there's differences in labor markets across states, and that are interesting to take into account, with some states having still more opportunities for immigrants to be engaged in labor market sectors that may not require a college degree, such as agricultural opportunities, versus other states that have a smaller agricultural sector.
Great. All right, so now we have a very difficult question. The question is, and Margie, I think maybe you can help us with this. It's that USCIS has been a little vague about providing evidence of continuing education for DACA renewal applicants who haven't graduated from high school or GE course at the time of the initial application. The question is, how can we encourage applicants to continue their education even though the evidence of continuance is not necessarily required for a DACA renewal?
Right. You know, I think that's an interesting question, both for the DACA renewal population and also for the very large share of potential applicants that don't have a high school diploma or equivalent, potentially have not applied, because it is it's not the far off in the distance 2-year degree that DREAM Act might have, and it's presumably shouldn't be that difficult for individuals to enroll in local programs. The way I read USCIS's approach to renewal and not requiring evidence is simply that it would just be administratively almost impossible, I think, to really get involved in a lot of the decisions around whether or not somebody, what kind of progress they've made, how far along they've gone, and that really the fact that they're enrolled is the standard just at the front end of the program. It's not necessarily required. It's not a critical element of the renewal process. In addition to it being so difficult for them to be able to track that and make adjudications about what are some very, very difficult administrative issues to try and figure out with local programs, the quality of their data, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of what programs might be able to do in order to encourage young people, I think we would say that it is all about, first of all, saying this is a golden opportunity to get back in services and to do something that is essential both for your life prospects, to have at least a high school diploma, and then to ideally be progressing on to some sort of integrated workforce training that is going to lead to a family sustaining wage, really make that system much more visible to immigrant youth and provide a motivational message that is critical both for their life prospects, their children's life prospects. And it's also a critical element of getting ready for potential DREAM Act legislation to be enacted. That legislation might not even have a window for those who are over 18 without their high school diploma or equivalent. And certainly if it has the 2-year requirement, it could be very difficult to meet that 2-year requirement in a short space of time that might be provided in legislation. So a motivational message about getting started now, I think, is needed. And so far we have not seen a lot of that sort of detailed, I guess, or motivational outreach to DACA eligible youth. And we think that there really is an opportunity here to try and fill that gap.
Fantastic. Thank you, Margie. So here I have a question, Nick, and I'll ask it of Jana. Was there anything in the results that surprised you?
Well, there were a couple of findings. Perhaps number one is the fact that with all the outreach and information available now about the DACA program, the Chinese youth are still notably absent among the top 20 or top 20, 25 even countries of origin, even though so many are eligible to apply. So that, of course, raises the question: why they don't apply, even though other Asian groups do. Granted, at the lower level than Latin Americans, but they still do. So that was one of the findings. Another one, we had a chance to look at the gender and age, and the fact that there is such a big difference between application rates for men and women. Again, raises the question, what are the opportunities, what are the targets of opportunities to encourage men to apply more? And so I would say that these two findings were the most surprising.
Anybody else have any surprises they want to share?
Sure, I'll mention one. Thanks, Michael. I think related to what Jana was just saying, the age breakdown was also somewhat surprising because really that's such a large share of applicants were those who were probably still in middle school or high school, those who were in the under 20 age range, or I believe it was even under 18 age range. And that really just shows that there has been a huge role played by high schools and the counseling infrastructure, and as well as sort of that critical point that happens when youth are at the post-secondary transition years and trying to figure out college applications, maybe learning of their unauthorized status for the first time as they're trying to fill out financial aid forms or get a job. And that's when we really see the highest DACA application rates. Conversely, some perhaps serious barriers for those that have been out of school for a while and might have a hard time documenting their presence in the United States, even if they really do qualify for DACA, just because they've not been formally involved in an educational institution for many years and could be harder to reach through outreach efforts. So these to us suggest opportunities for some continued mobilization and work in the field as just as renewal is underway, there's still great opportunities for first-time applicants.
Good. So here's an interesting question. Are we getting input from Asian communities and or organizations about the relatively low rates of applications from Asian youth in order to get more details and recommendations beyond the initial theories that we shared in today's presentation? Margie, do you want to talk a little bit about our ongoing work?
I would say that that's definitely part of our field work. We're looking at we're researching in several states right now that are have high concentrations of DACA eligible youth, looking at education success challenges and opportunities and sort of the overall rollout of the DACA program there, and are certainly doing a wide range of interviews trying to capture what might be some of the barriers that that heretofore have not really been on everybody's radar screen in terms of those populations, both from an sort of a willingness to apply point of view, and also from potential education success points of view.
So, Jana, we have three quick ones for you, so you're back in the box. Does the new data map take into account kids that have already applied and received DACA? Are those numbers broken out?
The tool that we have describes the population who's eligible, but it doesn't have information on application rates.
Okay.
Many of them potentially have applied, but we don't model that.
Do we have an estimated number of total eligible Asian or Pacific Islander youth nationwide?
Yes, we do. So according to our estimates, the overall total population is about 230,000 from Asian Pacific Island countries, and among them, about 150,000 are immediately eligible to apply.
Great. And so I have a question for all. How do we think about the 55% and 41% shares that we have discussed? Is it a glass half full, half empty? What's your take on that, since we have to answer the question day in, day out? Sarah, you want to take a lead?
Sure. It's a tricky question. In some ways, I think it is a glass half full and glass half empty type of story, but you can say that there has the 55%, from sheer numbers of over 600,000 applications accepted for processing by USCIS, that's a massive number that really reflects a very successful first few years, even first initial months of the program, as those numbers really picked up quickly after DACA was announced. We also see high rates already of those coming forward to renew. So I think that to a large extent that looks successful. On the other hand, especially, there is still, you could say, a very sizable group who we think are eligible who have not come forward to apply for the various reasons that we've discussed today, and especially when you consider those, the 41% rate, which includes those who did not appear to meet DACA's education requirements at the program's launch. Maybe they did not have a high school diploma, but may have since gone back to an adult education program. That also indicates that that among that group in particular, there's really a continued need for both efforts to get them back into education programs as well as applying for DACA. So I would say with regard to that group, the numbers are not looking quite as positive.
So here we have an interesting question, which is important to us because we have done so much work here at MPI on African migration to the United States, and since it's one of our, it's a subject that's very close to our heart and to our interests, why don't Africans appear in the data, or where are they in the data?
So we do have the estimates of those who are eligible to apply, about 69,000 of those born in Africa are eligible to apply. But in order to look at the application rates, we would need to have data from the USCIS, and USCIS publishes only information on the top 20 countries of origin. And even though we've been monitoring these stats from the first time USCIS published it, African applicants did not appear among the top 20 countries of origin. So we actually don't know, do they apply or not? I assume they do, but not to the degree that basically the lowest number that we have is as of through March 31st is for Pakistan. The number of applicants was 1,600 applications, which means that whatever other countries have made the applications to USCIS, it's lower than that number. So it is possible that immigrants from, let's say, Nigeria or Kenya are eligible, but they apply at such low numbers that they don't appear among the top 20 countries of origin.
Okay, here's a particularly good question. And Margie, maybe you should take a swing at this first. Given the high rates of high school dropout among undocumented Latino students, it would seem important for middle schools and high schools to get involved in advising their students and their parents in the benefits of staying in school and getting DACA. How engaged do you think the K-12 school system is in outreach and promotion of DACA, given your field work?
Well, I would say even though I think so this question gets a little bit at issues that we're looking at in a report that in our reports that will be coming out this fall. But we've had a very big interest in our field work around the country, trying to see what sort of efforts may be happening in K-12 school districts or individual high schools and middle schools, and of course, doing research on these issues is qualitative research in particular. You couldn't do quantitative, I guess, but qualitative even is so difficult when we have tens of thousands of school districts in the country and just, enormous numbers of actual middle and high schools. So it's very clear that certainly there are many examples to point to of high schools and middle schools that are doing work in this area. Even occasional examples of school districts trying to get the information out more broadly. But I think that the questioner points to a you know, a very important opportunity, both a challenge and an opportunity, the challenge of trying to reach young people with good information. And very often what we're finding is that school districts, they might be worried that they just don't have accurate information, that they might be giving the information, but then they don't know to whom they should refer individuals for help. Or they might be worried simply about controversy surrounding the program. And so one of the things we've been seeing in our site work is that trying to approach this from a school district level so that it isn't such a haphazard effort, and that you can more likely assure the quality of information and potentially tie the outreach into other sorts of supports that potential applicants would need, you know, seems to be the way to really address the range of issues that schools or school districts that might be looking to be helpful actually, you know, find it feasible to pursue to make a difference here.
Okay, one question which begs asking is, what explains the high turnout rates among Latinos within the program, Latino populations within the program? Obviously, what we're talking about here is common language, extensive media, density of community-based organizations, political climate in many states in which Latinos are heavily concentrated. And then some Latino populations are highly educated. You know, the Peruvians have high levels of application rates, and we assume that this is a population that is largely has high school and college education and is heavily concentrated in a few places in the United States. So it's not a uniform explanation across the populations. Do any of my colleagues want to add to that?
I think you summed that up well, Michael.
Yes,
there's a number of factors there, and I mean, definitely not to be ignored, the factor of immigration enforcement activity in certain states, and as well as discrimination against certain populations, and the fact that Latino immigrants in certain states might face great risks due to unauthorized status, and therefore have strong motivation to apply.
Okay, and so here's our last question, and this was touched on in the presentation, but maybe we could come back to it again. How should we think about the pace at which renewals are being filed? What's the indication, given that we have some initial numbers about renewals? How should we think about the pace? Sarah, I think that was part of your presentation. So.
Go ahead, John, if you want.
Well, we find it, so we looked at the number of applications that were submitted in the first 3 months of DACA back in 2012, and there were 53,000 approved. So the fact that in the first couple of weeks or 6 weeks when the window for renewals opened up on June 5th, the fact that 25,000 have already applied for renewal suggests that means that it's an impressive finding, and if the pace will continue, there is definitely a great demand for DACA and for the benefits that it offers. So from now on, we will be definitely thinking and look and study in two populations, those who apply initially and those who apply for renewals, because the motivations and the other factors that prompt people to apply for both will be somewhat different, and the opportunities and challenges that they face will be also different.
Okay, so we'll wrap up with that, and I want to thank the speakers, and I want to thank you all on the call for your very engaged and thoughtful questions over the course of this hour. I would just say that for any reporters on the call who want to follow up, you can call Michelle Mittelstadt, our Director of Communications, at 202-266-1910. And as a reminder, the audio and the slides from today's call and our new web tool will be available on our website today at www.latinoamericanstudies.org. migrationpolicy.org. And if you have any additional questions, please feel free to email any of us. And thank you for being with us.